You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good morning. Welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Joining me now is Dr. Ruben Steff, Senior Lecturer of the University of Waikato. Ruben joined us on our Foundation Members Call the other Sunday, the post-US election call, and had some really insightful stuff to say. And I wanted to hear more in the longer format. So we've got Ruben back for a decent chew fat in a chat. Good morning, Ruben. How are you?
Good morning, Maria. Lovely to be here. I'm glad you appreciated my rambling the other day. But that was a lot of fun. So happy to chop the world up again with you today.
It was brilliant. And there is so much to talk about, especially right now as departing US President Joe Biden, after spending months, if not years, saying no, no, no to tactical long-range missiles and having the Ukrainians allowed to use them from their territories into Russia. He's now given that the green light. I mean, call me cynical, but why, Ruben? Why now?
Look, I think there's two ways to think about this. The sort of traditional way, and what we're going to be seeing in the mainstream media, is that this is a parting shot at Trump to try and lock him in on a course towards kind of escalation or confrontation with Russia, rather than what Trump and his team have been saying, which is they want to try to de-escalate and eventually secure a deal with Putin to end the war. The other explanation, the one I probably tend towards, is that, no, this is probably coordinated between the campaigns, because Trump wants to negotiate from a position of strength. That's basically an official policy that harkens back to the era of Ronald Reagan and so on. Now, when Trump comes in, he will want to have as much negotiation leverage as he possibly can vis-a-vis Putin. He will not just cut and run. He will not 100% abandon Kyiv. He will have the memory of what happened in Afghanistan, where Biden withdrew US forces, and it led to horrible videos and photos of what happened to the major compounds and the deaths of US servicemen and, of course, Afghanis and so on. So I suspect this is actually coordinated, and it's a kind of potential compromise. You would have seen the images of Biden and Trump the other day, big smiles between them. So I think they probably came to a compromise on this issue, and Biden is working to some degree in cahoots with Trump to prepare the groundwork for eventual negotiations.
That is interesting, because Putin has said that if this were to happen, he would perceive that as NATO declaring war. I mean, will he retaliate if they fire missiles across into Russian territory?
Well, I mean, you probably heard in the last few days, they're already conducting the biggest strikes on Ukraine at the moment, of drones and missiles and so on. So in some respects, this Biden unleashing the gloves a bit on Ukraine is actually a reaction to Putin escalating first. And Putin is probably trying to shape the situation for those negotiations. And this is the response from the Americans. Now, will he escalate further? It is possible, or simply possible, he will decide, okay, let's wait for Trump now. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, thank you for your thoughts on that. I also note that Putin has brought the North Korean troops in. Has he run out of his own soldiers, or is he wanting to bring in a fighting force and shore up his allies, you know, out to the east?
From what I've gathered, no, he hasn't ran out of fighting forces, and Russian force generation has actually been pretty successful. Putin doesn't want to do another massive or partial mobilization, but nonetheless, apparently they do have the numbers they need. What this looks to be about is that Putin is receiving large numbers of drones, potentially missiles, artillery from North Korea. You may recall they essentially signed a military alliance a few months ago. I suspect part of that agreement was that North Korea wants to cut its teeth, so to speak. It wants some of its forces to get real world action on the ground, because there's no better experience than combat experience. You know, you can sit back, your forces can train, they can sit around in rooms and draw up maps and talk about doctrine, but the best way to learn about modern warfare is actually to get out there in the field. So I suspect this is kind of this will enable his forces, free up some of his forces to fight elsewhere, but I suspect this is more a kind of quid pro quo to help North Korean forces get experience, and they can take that learning, that training back to North Korea with them for their own purposes vis-a-vis South Korea.
All right. Well, it's definitely a watch this space over the next coming months, particularly before the inauguration of Donald Trump. Now, he's been very busy and making announcements left, right and centre, trying to fill his cabinet. And we've also got in this episode, we are talking to Trevor Loudon. Trevor and I discussed that when we recorded late last week. Now, for me, I come from the culture war space. So I've been watching this election really closely to see both the reactions of both sides, both the Democratic Party as well as their supporters, and also to the grassroots support that have come for Donald Trump. For me, I see this more than just a passing of the baton from one president back to another. For me, this has wider cultural implications. What have been your observations in that space?
Yeah, so on my run today, I was thinking to myself, how could we approach this topic? How could we frame it up in a broad way to give us some grounding? And what I kind of came up with is that in the US system, I think what we're seeing is a clash between two informational leviathans, in a way. You have the left, which is kind of the establishment now. It's arguably kind of stagnant. It's kind of like a cathedral. It has these doctrinaire thoughts, and everyone within it has to share those thoughts. If they show too much creativity or they self-critique their own side, they are cast out. You know, they're kind of cancelled, what have you. And that's become the establishment. On the right, you have another leviathan of information, culture, politics, and it seems to be more decentralized, more adaptive, innovative, and it's insurgent, right? It's kind of coming after the established establishment, and it has to be innovative. It has to find new ideas to challenge that. Because what really did come out to me in this election to some degree was that it kind of felt like the Democrats, the left-wing Leviathan, they didn't seem to have too many creative ideas. You know, they seemed to just be saying, let's kind of do the same old thing with a few twists here and there, a bit of a different policy there. Whereas on the right, you had this ragtag group around Trump. You know, you have J.D. Vance, a man of the new right, people like Elon Musk, Tulsi Gabbard, RFK, a very eclectic counter-elite that was emerging. And with them is coming a reaction to the left, to what Francis Fukuyama calls woke liberalism. You have this new right cultural and ideological force emerging. And I think this election showed the clash between these two spheres of thought. And to go back to the moment we are in, I mean, in 2016, Donald Trump is elected on a populist platform. He followed Obama. In Obama's own words, he was a populist too. So Hillary Clinton never perhaps had the energy to run. You know, the Democrats probably at that moment should have gone with Bernie Sanders. It was probably a strategic blunder that they didn't. Because Trump comes in, takes over from the populist Obama. Trump is a populist for 4 years. We then, because of coronavirus, have Biden winning. But that looks in retrospect like the blip. Had coronavirus not come along, Trump probably would have won in 2020 and continued that populist momentum and the response to the left cathedral, so to speak, the kind of anti-woke cultural response. But because Trump loses in 2020, we thought for a while Trump was the blip in 2016. But it now looks like 2020 was the blip with Trump back in power and the new right political philosophy carrying along with him.
You mentioned before, there's actually a few places that I want to go there. First one, and I just wrote this down, was New Enlightenment, because there's been a lot of, like, from the culture space now, there's a lot of talk about protection of the Enlightenment concepts and theories. And, of course, this sort of woke liberalism is anti-Enlightenment, anti a lot of those theories. They draw from Marxism, they draw from postmodernism, they've sort of pulled everything together into what I call a theological and ideological Frankenbaby. And that's where that has been sort of the establishment thought. Not that they would consider themselves establishment, I don't think. I think they still feel like they're this very nouveau Republican sort of Che Guevara-esque type movement. So in a way, is this new American resurgence with Trump and this eclectic group of people around him, this diverse voter base that has now risen up around him, is this a new American enlightenment?
I mean, the funny thing is, I imagine if we asked the vast majority of people that voted for Trump, you know, you look at the polling, a lot of it was just cost of living, runaway immigration, inflation, you know, bread and butter concerns. Nonetheless, from what I can tell, the working class is not really on board with the kind of woke left. They are more centrist or centre-right in their social and cultural orientations. So is this a new enlightenment? I think that's kind of a bold thing to say, but it seems to be a kind of reification of more traditional American values. And if we connect that to the enlightenment, things around, you know, free speech, to some degree, individuality, but within bounds, right? Because the new right will say, well, the woke left, they've embraced a very radical individualism, and it's taken it too far. And with that, it starts to sever cultural connections, our traditions. It starts to atomize society. You know, lots of young people these days who seem pretty listless. I mean, I see them at our universities in New Zealand. And many of the kind of values and behaviors and things that we have long cherished have kind of been considered, well, almost toxic or thrown in the dustbin of history. But nothing has really replaced it. You know, you do need to hold on to your tradition to some degree. You do need people to have feelings of duty, whether it's to their family or to their community. And those things have atrophied under the kind of the rise of the woke left. So enlightenment, perhaps it is a return to some of those concepts, yes.
I've just written to patriotism. You know, like there is a resurgence of patriotism in the United States. And I mean, I lived there in the late 80s. And so, of course, coming off the Reagan era and heading into Bush one. And there was a tremendous amount of patriotism in the country. Something, as a New Zealander, I found quite a culture shock. We didn't have that same level of fervour around a nationality that the Americans seem to have. And I wasn't expecting that. And it's almost like you can see they're trying to reclaim that now. So then this new right, as you referred to it, and you mentioned J.D. Vance. So I'm a huge fan of J.D. Vance. I haven't yet seen anything I don't like. Let's talk about him a little bit, because he is, I think, a really good signifier of this new right. And it's not just him. I mean, he's come out as the vice president-elect, but you've got other people, Ron DeSantis, Josh Hawley, Joe Cotton. There's a number of these young, vibrant politicians coming up through the political machinery. What does that signify now for the future of the right in the United States?
Yeah, well, it does show a new generation is perhaps waiting in the wings. I mean, you know, J.D. Vance is a much better articulator of Trumpism than Trump himself is. Mm. And in fact, you know, Trump, it's hard to know if he has any real ideology. You know, he's just kind of this chameleon that shifts directions, and he has a kind of animal guile for politics, and he's obviously a brilliant marketer. And I don't mean brilliant necessarily in the positive sense, just in the objective sense. You know, the man is a master at marketing himself and what he wants to get across, and sort of sowing the seeds of ideas and framing things in the way he wants, and the rest of us can pick up and run with it. But J.D. Vance, I mean, he is clearly a very sharp individual. And some of the other names you mentioned are sharp individuals. So you have the political new generation coming through. But I would say under that, you have philosophers, you have academics, you have podcasters, you have lots of people working under pseudonyms on YouTube, podcasting, like I said. But you have writers like Patrick Deneen, who is a conservative thinker, a very respectable one. He had a book in 2018 called Why Liberalism Failed, that Obama himself actually recommended as one of his must reads of the year, in which he talked about, hey, look, you know, liberalism is kind of destroying our community bonds, family structures, and so on. And we need to return to again, the tradition. So underlying this political elite we're talking of is a kind of ideological and philosophical set of ideas that is being transmuted up into the political elite. And then you have other people like Orrin McIntyre, Curtis Yarvin. Again, these are other people who are writing books that are getting out there, getting more attention, and they are kind of going after things like what they call the total state or the administrative state, where they say, hey, look, we've been sold this idea, we have all this freedom and all this autonomy, yet we see these giant state apparatuses spreading, administrators spreading, management spreading. You have this entire new class that sits between our leaders and the citizens. And this class in the middle managers, upper middle management, senior executives, and so on, they essentially create more jobs over time. They create work for themselves. They create ever-growing amounts of regulation that we feel as citizens but aren't necessarily making our lives better. In fact, they're entangling us more and more and more. And that's partly why, if you look at like what Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy want to do, they've come in and said, we have a mandate to basically start massively trying to rip out a lot of this middle level. Because the problem here is that at the highest level, if you're a politician or a senior manager, the further away you are from the citizens or your employees, the less you understand the repercussions of your decisions for the people at the ground level. So you start to get this massive distance between those who had the responsibility and making the top decisions and the rest of us who are experiencing the repercussions of it and not getting the benefits that they tell us they're trying to give us.
I watched an interview with Jeffrey Tucker, who's an economist. I don't know whether you're familiar with Jeffrey's work. He's also the founder of the Brownstone Institute. So he's one of these alternative media people in that space. And he was talking about exactly what you were referring to, which I and my friend, my colleague, we call the blob.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just sort of seems to grow by this absolute accretion and no one can really pinpoint what it is. It's a squidgy mess that no one can really figure out what it is that they do. Tucker was talking about, Jeffrey Tucker, as opposed to Tucker Carlson. Jeffrey Tucker was talking about the concerns he has around inflation, because he said that the other thing that the Americans have been doing, particularly across the last 4 years, is being completely refusing to acknowledge in any way, shape or form, and especially Janet Yellen, that there is a recession in the United States, and the recession has been there since the second quarter of 2022. And with Trump coming in, one, he's got to tackle the recession. He needs to tackle the true rate of inflation that Americans are now facing, and obviously what they've acknowledged at the polling booth when they voted, but also this blob, this layer of bureaucracy in between. Do you think Trump, with Vivek and Elon and this DOGE, you know, what is it, Department of Government Efficiency, are going to go all Harvey and Malay on this? Are they going to have the bravery to do that, do you think?
Well, you might have seen the first meeting Trump had with the foreign leader was Malay from Argentina. He came to Mar-a-Lago only a few days ago to meet them and I think share stories and tips and so on. I think if you know anything about Elon Musk, he's going to try his bloody hardest. There's a great biography that came out earlier this year by Walter Isaacson all about Elon Musk. And nothing was off the record. Isaacson said Musk let me talk to his family members, former lovers, current lovers, children. He could talk to anyone he wanted completely unfiltered. So you do get a very true accounting of where Elon Musk has come from and where he's going. And where you, what you see, what you discover is, I mean, the man is hyper-competent. He comes into any industry or any organization and radically transforms them, makes them incredibly efficient. He barely sleeps. He understands the interconnections between all these different sectors of the economy, different elements of his business operations. He is a bit of a freak of nature. And I suspect if he actually has the power to do so, he will go in and do a diagnostic of what's happening across the American government and make very severe recommendations. He said he wants to cut $2 trillion out of the U.S. federal budget, which is $6.5 trillion. Now, whether this can be done, I don't know. He will try. I gather he has 2 years, him and Vivek Ramaswamy. Within 2 years, they are then to meet to kind of provide a plan to the federal government to say, hey, this is what we think needs to be done. So I don't know if as they go, there will be cuts and so on, or see if they're going to put together a big blueprint that 2 years from now they will hand deliver to the White House for what needs to be done. And the department also is not an official government department. Apparently it sits outside the government itself. So I don't think it has any kind of executive authority to make changes or decisions. Rather, it's going to recommend things. But yes, I think Milei is going to be something of a template. It's going to be a little bit different. I mean, the American system is different. They are the reserve currency, so they can just spend well beyond their means. But look, I would point out something like 10 years ago, I remember there was lots of talk about the US debt. There's just none in recent years, and yet the debt has exploded astronomically, goes up and up and up. So eventually some president, whether it was Trump, whether it was Harris, whether it's one of their successors, is going to have to deal with this situation. And now may simply be the moment where they think, oh, we have a moment, we have a mandate to try it. They are surrounded by some pretty capable people. Yes, some other people who look a bit odd, and I'm a bit surprised at some of the cabinet picks, but having someone like Elon Musk around is maybe the moment you go, let's pull the trigger and actually try transform the system while we can, because we may never have a chance again. And if we don't try reduce it and transform it now, instead the system may just stumble along to its ultimate demise and decline.
Mm. So what surprised you in the cabinet picks?
Gates is probably the major surprise.
Yeah, do you think that he'll get Senate approval, though? Trevor reckons they will. Trevor Loudon, who I speak to, he reckons that they've got their mechanism, that sort of arcane mechanism, and I can't remember the name of it, that they may pull to get Gates across the line. But I think that these sexual abuse allegations are going to dog him all the way there.
I don't think they will. And I'm also not sure, this is when I'll get a bit far flung with my thinking.
Don't worry about far flung in this show, my friend.
Awesome. I don't know if they ever intended for him to get it or believed he could. But what this then becomes is a forcing function to see where the Republican Party stands, right? Because what Trump has done in recent years is he's transformed the party methodically into his party. And he has put his thumb on the scale of people that support him. And in time, you've seen the rhinos have to leave the party. You've seen people that oppose Trump have to leave the party. And I wonder if they see an opportunity to try use these cabinet picks to sense who's going to support us and who isn't. And we can send signals like, if you don't support us now, 2 years from now, we will primary you out as well. And Elon Musk has said his PAC, which supported Trump to the tune of about 200 million in the recent election, it's going to stick around for the midterms. And it will be supporting candidates that Musk and Trump want to back. So there's going to be looming in the background of all of this big blade, if you will, this kind of implicit threat that if you don't support Trump now, there could be repercussions for you down the line. Now, that may not be enough. I think some will vote for Gates and some will obviously vote not. And I don't think he'll get over the line. But I just wonder if there is something, a bit more of a broader strategy going on.
Yeah, and there also too, I mean, obviously with the Senate, with Mitch McConnell, I mean, he hung in there for way too long. I mean, there's plenty of talk about Biden's cognitive issues. They've kind of brushed McConnell's under the carpet a little bit because he seriously got declines there as well. And there've been a core of Republicans who have been very, very supportive behind him, which I think if I were the Mitt Romneys and the like, I'd probably be starting to feel a little bit uneasy in my seat, I would have thought, coming through, yeah. So let's sort of pivot now a little bit, because you also mentioned with Obama and then with Trump in 2016 that they sort of rode in on this wave of populism, and Obama was a populist president. And I'm glad you said that, because all of a sudden, in recent years and in recent times, well, if you were to listen to the legacy media, you would have thought populism was a bad thing. Why are they suddenly demonising what I would have thought has been a keystone of democracy since democracy began?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, go back to the Roman Empire. They had their populists. I mean, I try to tell my students sometimes, go read books. Please, go back and have a look at periods of human history, and you'll see many of the things playing out today that we get so outraged about. It's played out in many different ways in the past. So try not to get too caught up in it or too emotionally caught up in it, so to speak. Well, populism, I mean, look, it just depends upon whether it's your populist or not. Had Bernie won in 2016, I mean, I was a Bernie bro, so to speak. I loved Bernie. Most of my friends loved Bernie. Everyone was super excited about Bernie. And then, of course, they went with Clinton. But had Bernie won in 2016 and, you know, let's say made dramatic or positive change, and maybe he wins in 2020 or a successor does, then of course populism wouldn't be considered this kind of rabble-rousing negative political force. It would, because it would be the force that the kind of legacy media agrees with and the Democratic Party agrees with. And look, there are certain aspects of populism that can be concerning. We see around the world, including the United States, that sometimes this rhetoric does seem to be designed partly for the designs of the individual who is using the rhetoric, right? We see populists, they often do struggle to govern. I mean, I think it will be different this time for Trump because he will have learned and he's surrounded himself by different people and he has more power, more of a mandate than 2016. But populists typically have sometimes struggled to govern, and so what they do is they create the perpetual campaign. They're always campaigning to keep the energy going, to keep trying to use that as the legitimating factor for their presidency. Whereas rather, if you're making good decisions, good policy decisions, it's improving people's lives, you shouldn't have to keep rabble-rousing, right? The product, the outcome should show that what you're doing justifies it on its own sake, not just because you get up there and give these big rallies and you yell and scream and divide and so on. So there are concerns with populism, but back to your fundamental question, it's because, you know, people on the left like left-wing populism, people on the right like right-wing.
There has certainly been a shift, and you're currently, as we speak, in the Czech Republic. So there has been a shift in especially Europe around a lot of populist candidates. And one that this new wave was Giorgia Meloni. I remember the criticism when she formed a coalition in Italy around her connections to older, more established political figures, let's say, and they were gravely concerned. But she's actually now proven to be very, very effective in a stabilising effect, I think, within the EU. And there are now being more of these leaders who are starting to be elected. I think the UK is actually an outlier in the current political shift. Give me some of your thoughts and observations of what you see in Europe that is going on, and with some of the changes and the swings, whether that be from right to left, and some of these populist movements which have been popping up, from farmers to people that are again concerned about immigration or the economies of Europe and the EU, and do they stay or do they go?
Europe has had a number of populist movements in recent years, and you know, there's been times when it started to decline and people said, oh, we're kind of over peak populism in Europe, but it doesn't look like it. There's been a number of recent prime ministers and presidents elected in this part of the world on populist platforms. I wonder if it almost goes back to what I was talking about earlier, this critique of the kind of administrative state, where just increasingly people don't feel like their elites truly represent them or understand them or are working for their interests to benefit their lives, because you know, the elite, for the most part, they just live in a different world to us. They have multiple homes. They fly around the world. They don't have any of the real day-to-day concerns that people in the working class do, or people in the middle class do. So I think something structural is occurring here in Europe and other parts of the world, where the average person is just, they're a bit fed up. Things were improving seemingly for a long period of time, but we're either stagnant now or even declining in some parts of the world. And in that situation, people are willing to take a risk, I think. You know, if your situation doesn't look great, if you worry about the future for your kids, well, yes, there might be the populist there who is kind of rabble-rousing and saying, follow me, I'm going to tear up the system. You might think, well, this is high risk, but it's also potentially high reward. My current situation isn't very good. Whereas if things are going pretty well, well, you're probably not willing to take that risk when it comes to voting. You're just going to stick to the status quo. So I think there's some structural problems that we're dealing with, and that's why populism in Europe and elsewhere is like retaining its potency.
Mm. So the Germans, since you're over there and I've got you, Ruben, sure. I may as well just, you know, tick off all my lot of points that I've, so the Germans. So it's just explain for people that are not aware, but the Germans have politically are in a little bit of a poo at the moment. So where are they at and what do you think they're likely to do before the end of the year?
Well, look, I do typically try to stay to what I know, and I'm following that very far removed. But what I understand, when this government came in, from inception, apparently, it was pretty flimsy. It was on unshaky legs. And I think it's just led to the ultimate conclusion, which is it's falling apart. I think they also have not done great vis-a-vis Ukraine. I gather parts of their economy are not doing very well. They're sort of wedged between, on one side, you know, China and the United States. And the US, you know, despite the fact you're talking earlier about, you know, they have economic problems in the US, the US is growing by about 2%. The problem is just a big part of the electorate not feeling that the benefit of that 2%. Nonetheless, the American economy continues to kind of prosper, if you will. This notion of American decline economically isn't really correct when you look at the fundamentals and the metrics. And the Americans have Silicon Valley. They have oil and gas out the wazoo. They have some of the brightest, most innovative people on the planet. Whereas Europe is fragmented. It's a bunch of different nations with this European superstructure. It's finding it very hard to cohere into a whole. to make strategic decisions amongst themselves. And Europe is just, sorry, Germany is just in the middle of that. And I think they are really struggling to find their way in this new emerging multipolar world. And people are kind of fed up as well there. That I haven't got any great direct answer for you here. It just strikes me that I've been watching Europe for many years now, and it just feels like they're constantly stumbling along, plugging gaps, and just really showing a real strategic coherence. And I think, their countries are kind of victims of that.
Yeah, so Douglas Murray in his book in 2017, I think it was The Strange Death of Europe, talked about that cohesion, and he talked about the effect that mass migration had on actually unpicking the weave and weft of the social fabric in Europe. And then you also mentioned before the blob, and the EU in itself has become a bit of a blob. I mean, it was there to help pull countries together to enable them to move freely and trade as a bloc. And that in itself is starting to disintegrate. Are they potentially needing a dose of Trumpism across in Europe to help pull things back together, do you think? That sort of thinking. And how do they get it? I mean,
I don't know. There are just levels and levels of bureaucracy in Europe. Even within countries, there's levels and levels of bureaucracy. And they can be quite rigid. I mean, I'm here in the Czech Republic where my wife is from, and you know, paperwork, forms, following the letters of the law. I mean, partly it comes from the communist time, but it also just comes from their bureaucratic traditions, so to speak. So within countries, there's a lot of bureaucracy. And then, of course, you have the EU superstructure put on top of it. I think you're going to have to see a kind of, you're going to have to get the Germany, France, Italy, the Netherlands, you're going to have to get the kind of core of Europe to come together and say, we are going to forge a vision forward for Europe. Of course, the problem with that is it means the fringes of Europe and some of the smaller countries might say, no, we are not going to let you guys completely cut through here. They may need a real crisis. I mean, they have had crises, right? They had the Eurozone crisis. COVID was another crisis. Ukraine, Russia is certainly a crisis. Nonetheless, despite all these crises they've faced in Europe, they still haven't been able to overcome their national kind of differences and the desire. You know, these are very different countries. You know, Germany is not far from where we are in the Czech Republic. But if I go from the Czech Republic to Germany, very different cultures, very different languages. And then you crisscross that all across Europe. And then you're trying to create a European Union, not just an economic union, but initially the ambition was to try to create a political union. Trying to create that out of what Europe is seems to be beyond the Europeans for now. Maybe a great crisis will come along and force them together. I know Macron. You know, Macron talks a big game all the time. So some of them do have these ambitions where they really do want to try to transform Europe into something more coherent. But I don't see any real strong signals that is imminent.
Yeah, indeed. Now let's get on to the China question, because you brought it up briefly before, and I know that this is an area of expertise for you. So China, now with the Trump presidency about to get started in the new year, what's going on currently in terms of a potential escalation now and with Russia and Ukraine? What do you think Xi's up to? I mean, it's, you never quite know with the Chinese of where they're at in terms between militarily and from a business perspective. So do you think that they're just sitting there biding their time?
I think so. But a bit like Putin in Ukraine, they will be trying to think through ways, how can they prime the situation for their advantage once Trump gets in? Now, they can do that in different ways. Some are riskier than others. Kinetically, they could rock the cage in parts of the Pacific, South China Sea, Philippines. Who knows, even the South Pacific in a worst-case scenario for us. But they could do things. They could show further support for Russia, but they're already essentially providing a lot of support for Russia already. I find it very hard to know what the equation is for China because it's not transparent. We know they do not release all sorts of statistics now that they did only a few years ago. They're probably fudging a lot of the numbers as well. We know they have big economic problems. We know their youth population are very dissatisfied, pretty significant levels of unemployment amongst the youth as well. They have a demographic crisis that's already biting. They are going to get old, arguably, before they get rich. Demographics are potentially going to fall off a cliff in the coming decades. And they'll be hoping that artificial intelligence and robotics can replace the working base they need to support all these seniors. But it's not sure that they can. So they maybe either out of necessity or to preempt some calamity, I think they may get ready to deal with Trump because they face real problems, I think, from my reading of the tea leaves. We hear reports repeatedly that Xi is in a very fragile position, that he is trying to direct the military to prepare for war, to reabsorb Taiwan by 2027. But apparently there's kind of a rebellion among the ranks and even within the military itself. So there's some suspicions that Xi is kind of fighting on multiple flanks internally. And if he was to, say, try and launch an invasion of Taiwan, that the military would either not follow the order or would turn completely against him. But it's so hard to know. I mean, this is criminology, right?
Mm.
Throughout the Cold War, there were people who would sit there, they would look at who was surrounding Khrushchev. You know, who was to Khrushchev's left and right? Oh, okay, this leader, this military figure. What did this tell us about the power structure and the debates within the Kremlin? I think to some degree, it's a bit like that with China right now too, where there's just such an unknown. You know, it's kind of the fog of war, so to speak. China is not transparent. It's so hard to truly know what the facts are. But it does seem like they're having major economic problems internally. You know, that they need large economic growth to justify their system. And it's slowed down a lot. You know, even some economists say, look, when China is reporting 5% growth a year, it's probably more like 2 to 3%. So I cannot really tell you. I can give you a bit of the context, a bit of the uncertainty. But if I was them, I think they might be setting up to try and negotiate with Trump. Because Trump is a transactionalist. Trump doesn't care if you're a democracy or dictatorship. He doesn't care if you believe in human rights. He doesn't care about Xinjiang. He doesn't care about Hong Kong and so on. He wants deals that, in his mind, will materially benefit the United States. So it's possible that we will see some compromise here, some kind of, I don't know if breakthrough is too strong a word, but Trump may be able to come in and help Xi Jinping stabilize the Chinese economy, and in return, he'll get something for that. I'm not sure. Maybe it'll be a kind of de facto commitment to give up, at least for the time being, aspirations of reabsorbing Taiwan back into the mainland or something. But it's going to be a fraught period. It's already a fraught period. We do have something like a new Cold War underway. It's different to the last Cold War, but tensions have been intensifying in recent years between the Americans and the Chinese, which has implications for the rest of us. But if I'm Xi and I truly am surrounded by all these problems, I need to find some space, some buffer space to work my way through these problems.
Well, I think also that you mentioned demography. I mean, they're now starting to try and encourage people to have more than one child after a one-child policy that lasted absolute decades. And they don't import workforce like we do in this country and other places. And in the day job, we do a bit of business with China. And I know that we've certainly seen in that space, which is in textiles, is that there has been a sort of a slowing down, like things that were incredibly efficient and done just boom, 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 with no issues. You can tell that there's pressure applied on those manufacturers up there. And we think that a lot of those pressures are like what we see in this country. You're struggling to get workforce there, maintain them, keep them, because they're just not coming through anymore. So, and I think a lot of these new parents are not either not wanting to have children or are not wanting to have more than one, certainly. So that is a pretty dangerous place to be. And I think globally, I mean, I know I'm getting off topic in your special area, but democracy, you know, from that demographic perspective, do you see this plummeting of the birth rate, especially across developed nations, of a deep concern for the decades moving forward, like my children and your children?
Yeah, I mean, growing up, I probably was of the kind of persuasion that there were too many people, you know, we're damaging the earth and maybe it'd be good to slow down the population. I think what increasingly I'm seeing as someone with two young boys and worrying about the future for them is that this demographic decline, I mean, it's for a range of reasons. One of it is affluence. And as people get wealthier in countries, they decide to have less kids. They want to have more leisure time and so on. But increasingly, we are seeing people choosing not to have kids because they just think they can't afford it and they don't have faith in the future. That's really tragic. If many young people and people in their 30s and maybe even early 40s, they don't want kids because they have just thrown their hands up and said, well, the future is screwed. It's going to be the zombie apocalypse. That's really sad. That affects, I think, the kind of further affects probably the social fabric of our societies. And, you know, we have mental health anxiety increasing. We know men are becoming more conservative, women more liberal. And all these things, I think, are potentially bound up in a kind of narrative, a sort of constant barrage of negative news media stories telling everyone everything's turning to shit, which is not entirely true. I mean, I do think we have hit a bit of a stagnant period, a decadent period in recent years, but we need to find a way to inspire people. And I think if people are inspired, birth rates will start ticking up again, and that will be all for the good. Because, look, our countries are aging. We're going to need to replace the workforce somehow. Otherwise, we're just going to pass the burden onto the next generation, the monetary burden that the next generation already feels. I mean, I can tell you from my young students at university, very anxious, very worried about the future. They don't think they're going to be able to own homes. They don't know if they're going to be able to have kids and even afford it. Even me and my wife, we struggle to save money these days. So even some of us that have quote-unquote good jobs are finding it a bit tough thinking about the future and how we're going to save up for our retirements and so on. Come back to the demographic factor, I think that just all plays into all of this. If we can't find a way to turn some of these things around, it's possible we enter into kind of a societal just decline, death spiral. And I'm not a kind of a doomer, so to speak. I'm not entirely, I haven't taken too many, you know, black pills, but I'm a bit fearful of some of the trends we're seeing. And then some of, again, the kind of philosophical or cultural strains we see that sometimes seem to celebrate some of these trends as if it's a good thing for the planet and therefore it's good for all of us. Well, no, I think we need a balance here. You think what's good for everyone, what's good for the youth, what's good for people's mental health, and probably living in a society where we feel we're on the up and up, and if we innovate and work hard, we can have a normal middle-class lifestyle. That's what we need to aspire to restore.
So then if we take this full circle back to the Trump election and this American re-emerging American optimism, do you hope this and think that that could be, from a cultural perspective, contagious?
I hope so. I mean, I think if the Americans do well in the coming years, they will pull the rest of us along with them. The only reason I would hesitate a bit there is that the information space is completely splintered now. I mean, people everywhere just going into the echo chambers. So if you are stuck in a negative echo chamber of information, you may just continue to spiral into that echo chamber. But I would hope we're going to see greater, almost like compromise between the two sides to some degree. I mean, the legacy media are clearly in decline and in trouble. And we have the kind of new media being established of podcasts, YouTube and X and social media. And I think a lot of it comes down to education. You can never be more informed about the world than you can right now, or human history. But you have to just approach the world, not by taking the blue pill or the red pill, but take the purple pill. You know, you need to open up your echo chamber as broadly as possible. Talk to as many people as possible. Read the great works of fiction and history and literature. Watch documentaries about all sorts of topics. You have to be uncomfortable. And this is difficult. I mean, I sometimes have conversations with friends and family where I can just tell they don't like what I'm telling them. And it's not even because I'm giving them a political opinion. I might just be questioning the factual basis of their opinion or saying, oh, well, maybe have you thought of listening to someone on the other side who has a different view to you? People don't want to hear that. People are very tribal right now, increasingly tribal because they're in this world of kind of informational chaos. I think we just have to embrace the opposite and kind of look at every stream of information if you can, left wing, right wing, alternative, center. And if we can do that, and if we can train the students coming through today, that's okay. They will be uncomfortable at times, but ultimately they'll be more informed, they'll be more inspired, they'll have a better picture of what's happening in the world, the better off we will all be. And look, I'll just leave one final thing here. People should be reading books. I know it sounds like, makes me sound like an old man. Go read about the Roman Empire, the medieval period, the medieval totalitarian institutions. Read about New Zealand history. This stuff, once you start reading all this stuff, it gives you so much more perspective to look at the world today. And it helps you see that things are not entirely doom and gloom, that there's been many periods throughout human history where things have been very tough. In fact, for all our ancestors, they had much, much tougher lives than we did. We have lives of leisure now, and we almost don't know what to do with it, I think, which is part of the problem. So we just need to kind of recenter, educate, expand people's minds, not limit their minds.
Well, on that note, that's very inspiring. And also, I like that, take the purple pill. There you go. I think it's something that's really important for our kids too. And I know that with the sons that I have, the youngest, his favourite subject is history. And he learns so much from that. And he'll come home and he'll go, did you know? Because that's, you're right, you know, information has moved so quickly and there's so many alternative forms of media. And sometimes, and I've often said this to my boys, in order to move forward, you need to look backward. So. Yep. There you go. Hey, Ruth, this has been an absolute delight. Dr. Ruben Steff, Senior Lecturer from the University of Waikato, is talking to us all the way from the Czech Republic this morning. So thank you. It's been great to catch up. And if you want to, if people want to catch up a little bit more with you, Ruben, how can they interact with you? Are you on the X, or do you have a Substack or anything that I should point people in the direction of?
Sure, I am on X. I think it's just at Ruben Steff. I'm on LinkedIn if people want to add me there. Just Google my name, Ruben Steff. You can look at my publications, what I do for a day job, my academic career. I'm continuing to put things out. I have a new book coming out in February 2025 called New Zealand's Geopolitics and the US-China Competition. Google my name and you will discover what I do. So thanks, Dee Marie. Thanks, Dee Marie. It's been a great chat.
You're most welcome. We'll get you back when the book comes out, because that sounds fantastic. As I said, this is Ruben Steff, Senior Lecturer, University of Waikato. Don't disappear. More here to come here with Counterculture on Reality Check Radio.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.